Andy Offutt Irwin, welcome to Tonic.
Thank you. It's good to be on Tonic.
It is great to have you here. You and I have met before. We've met at the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee, back in 07, and we had a chance to chat a little bit. And
we did.
I'm grateful that we have another chance to chat. I want to read something here for our listeners. This is a quote. I'm not sure if this is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution or from some other source.
Okay.
Some people have inner kids. Andy Offutt Irwin has an outer kid. With a manic, silly putty voice, astonishing mouth noises, and hilarious stories, he is equal parts mischievous schoolboy and the Marx Brothers, peppered with a touch of the Southern balladeer, and is one vibrantly odd bird with feathers that tease, tickle, and tug at the heart, and a whopper of a personality which barely fits in most rooms. People are drawn to him like magnets to a refrigerator, and inside it's all Mountain Dew and Jolt Cola. Now, I know you're a good Southern boy and with a good dose of humility, but I got to say right now, Andy, it's all true.
Oh, thank you so much. That's from a guy named Frank Raby in Asheville, North Carolina.
Well, I can attest, as someone who has heard your stories of laughing maniacally one moment, talking about the audience now.
Oh, thank you.
And having goosebumps the next. It is amazing to me. Where do these stories come from, Andy?
Well, I was raised by Southern women, so I imitate a lot of them. And Marguerite is the voice of my grandmother, who was born in 1894. And the attitude of my mother, and anything that I want to gripe about, I put into her voice, and nobody feels bad about me.
Tell us a little bit about Marguerite.
Marguerite's 85, just recently graduated from medical school. She and her friends, three friends, my girlfriends and our husbands have passed on, and we were tired of the bridge club and the garden club, so we all went back to medical school.
Well, I got to tell you, as a guy who went through med school in his 20s, it was rough then. What's it got to be like for an octogenarian?
Thank you. Well, we studied hard. We had nothing better to do.
Oh. And after medical school, they opened up a hospital.
Yes, in Deep Step, Georgia, called Southern White Old Lady Hospital.
And you actually have had the fruits of that hospital as they ministered to you after an injury.
That's right. That's right. I broke my ribs, you know, because I was trying to get some boxes out of the dumpster behind the liquor store for my Aunt Florence, who was moving to Virginia. And after I broke my ribs, I had to, you know, flop around on the ground for a while, and I drove myself straight to Southern White Old Lady Hospital, where they worked on me with their portable X-ray machine.
Which at least some of the staff of the hospital didn't quite know what it was.
Well, you know, Lewis, the custodian, thought that it was a floor waxer, but he couldn't get it to work.
thank God.
That's right.
You know, in finding out some things about you, Andy, I respect and admire a whole lot. Amongst them, the fact that you have actually worked in Renaissance festivals.
Oh, that's right.
And I know for a fact those aren't easy.
That's hard work. I did five shows a day. I did the Kansas City Renaissance Festival a long time ago in the 80s, and then the Georgia Renaissance Festival here. I worked with the Atlanta Shakespeare Company, and we would do the tragical, terrible story of Hamlet. Of course, I played Gertrude. and we would do King Lear and Romeo and Juliet, and then I had my own show called Off of the Minstrel featuring Appleboy, and a lot of storytelling fans might know Appleboy. A lot of people don't know that Appleboy started out as a fire eater.
Oh.
A fire-eating apple.
Oh.
There's no other way to explain that, but that we used real torches and Coleman fuel, and I would have my apple puppet eat fire. It's a living.
It sounds like one of a kind.
I was about to lose my stage, and the director said, you know, we're looking at a fire-eating act, and I said, I've got a fire-eating show. I didn't tell her I was not the one eating fire, but that lasted for 3 years, so that worked.
So now you play Gertrude, and I guess in keeping with a long tradition of British comedy, which finds much humor in men dressing up in women's clothes, there was something in your college years along these lines too, wasn't there?
That's right. I was Mess Georgia College, 1978, and then I ended up giving the crown away three more times because I was the only one that would continue dressing in drag. So I was an award-winning drag queen a long time ago, and actually playing Dr. Marguerite in the festival circuit, I like to think of myself as the favorite female impersonator of the festival circuit.
Hands down. and
if anybody wants it.
Well, you know, I want to talk about some other various facets of your jobs and careers and all that you do. But getting back to that storytelling for just a moment,
sure.
It's my understanding that Carmen Deedy was a catalyst for getting you into the storytelling world.
She was. We met, probably 12 years ago, actually at the Renaissance Festival through some friends that we knew there. And we went to dinner with those friends, and it ended up being one of those 2.5 hour, you know, bunch of comedians at a table going at it. And Carmen, before I knew what the storytelling circuit was or that there was a genre, she said, "You're a storyteller." And she was very generous, and we split a show at the 14th Street Playhouse in Atlanta, a storytelling show. And it was the first performance that I had ever done in storytelling without my guitar, which I just left at home just to stretch myself a bit. And it opened my eyes to it, and I became very excited about it. And when I submitted my stuff to the National Festival and was accepted in 2005, Carmen's daughter was one of my students in a play I was working on, and Carmen came to the rehearsal, and I didn't know that she knew that I had been accepted. I said, "Hey, guess what? I'm going," and she said, "Don't embarrass me." prepare. I said, okay. If you know Carmen, she's very clear.
Oh, yes.
She was extremely instrumental.
Now, you've got the National Storytelling Festival coming up in Jonesboro, Tennessee, in the early part of October.
Right.
And also of interest to our listeners in the Kentucky area and surrounding states, and perhaps soon to be on a very national scale, is the Cave Run Storytelling Festival.
Yeah, it's an amazing festival. It's huge. I can't remember who else is on the bill, but this will be my second time there. I think I was there in 2006. So I'm very excited to be returning. It's such a beautiful setting and really exceptionally cool people. And the last time I was there, it rained all night, one of the nights, and people were still there. they were all crowded into the tents, and it was tons of fun. So beautiful and so much fun.
A very beautiful environment. Just about 60 miles east of Lexington and near Moorhead, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely beautiful area, as is Jonesboro, Tennessee. So those of us who live in the southeastern part of the United States have the blessing of being very near those venues.
Yeah, they're really wonderful. And at Jonesboro this year, I'll be doing only one show. That'll be the Friday Night Cabaret at 10:30 on Friday night. And I would like for some people to know that the Southern Black Old Lady Midwives will be there, as well as my band, which is known as Andy Offutt Irwin versus the Finger Monsters.
Well, now, that's a segue into something else I wanted to ask you about. In addition to storytelling, you are a very musically inclined person, and you've been performing with the Kandinsky Trio.
Yeah, that's right. what a scam. We met at the 2005 National Festival, and they heard me whistle, and I talked with them, and they talked with me, and I whistle with them. And we've done a couple of shows now, three shows now, and we have a few more scheduled. My favorite one was when we did perform at Roanoke College. The newspaper listed me as a professional wrestler instead of whistler.
Oh, my goodness.
So we ran out and got a wrestling belt from the Kmart, you know, for me to present out on stage. And we had tons of fun. But they're amazing musicians. They're such an amazing piano trio. And we did the Dvorak, and we did a Romanian pan flute concerto, and some jazz, some Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington.
Now, were you the wind instruments in this?
I'm the wind instrument, and using different embouchures, you know, there's pucker whistle, which, you know, And then there's the pan flute, which is a... So, you know, the different kinds of whistling and, yeah, and the wind instrument.
I heard a great story about you, speaking of whistling, and I wondered if it were apocryphal or if it were true, that at one point you asked a member of an audience, ask me if I smoke.
Right.
And your answer was to whistle for over a minute.
About a minute and a half without apparently breathing.
And then your laconic reply was, no.
That's correct. That's almost all my children's shows I do that. And sometimes, and in Jonesboro, you can do your children's show in front of the grown-ups because, and at K-Brun, too, that audience is trained. So you can be hanging out in front of those 60-year-olds, and they'll turn into 8-year-olds real fast.
Well, I think it's a unique gift of you and many of your colleagues in storytelling at Cave Run and at the National Storytelling Festival that not only do you have an inner and outer kid, but you break through the layers that accrue over time in us grown-ups and allow us the privilege of getting back to that kid.
That's really true, and that's one of those things that storytelling does. And I've been in show business, gosh, a full-time pro since 1984. But the storytelling community, and that includes the tellers, the presenters, and the audience, those are the coolest people in show business. Those are the people that are really ready to accept what you have to offer. If you want the audience to turn into to 300 8-year-olds, they will. The willingness is there because you're bringing up childhood memories, mine, which trigger the audiences. And then we really do become a community of an audience. An audience becomes related in a way. It is an amazing thing to watch, and I'm so happy, and I feel so privileged to be part of that.
Well, I'm wondering too, Andy. You mentioned that a kernel, the catalyst of this interest in this profession of yours, was hanging around Southern women as you grew up. Bill Cosby was also an influence.
Right. Oh, yeah. Sure. Well, what Bill Cosby was doing, especially in his earlier stuff, was storytelling. They were long narratives, some of them 15 minutes long, if you have those old Bill Cosby records.
Oh, yes.
And I listened to that stuff when I was 10 years old. I started really listening to that. In fact, I started reciting them in school, and I was the kind of student that you might imagine that I was. And one of my teachers said, okay, when I'm doing the lunch reports, instead of turning on the educational television, she would let me do literal Bill Cosby monologues, and I would stand in front of class when I was a kid and do that. And I've often said, if Bill Cosby were around now, starting out, he would be doing the storytelling circuit as much as he would be doing the stand-up circuit, because the stand-up circuit, of course, is much different than when he was around as a young man.
I think that's why the moniker comedian doesn't really begin to touch him or to those of you performing currently.
I couldn't agree more. That's true. That's true. And stand-up, you know, we're coming out of a bad period. Well, I don't know how long. I can really kind of go on a lecture on what has happened to stand-up. We're coming out of a bunch of Xerox copies of the observational stuff in the 70s and a bunch of Xerox copies of ironic stuff in the 80s, and what we have now is a lot of... what I call observational contempt, where a comedian will look at anything that he sees at once and have contempt for it. Like, oh, wow, there's some potted plants hanging from the house. Hello, what's up with that?
Yeah.
So it's sort of, where's the joke in that? Where's the story? Where's the heart? So, yeah.
I think heart is something that comes again and again in your performances. I'm thinking of Marguerite, Aunt Marguerite, M.D., who... Mm-hmm. Grew up in the Old South and who at one point in her life becomes a reformed racist.
Right. She is, as she puts it, I'm a recovering racist. You know, you're working out the change of heart all the time. And of course, I grew up with these folks, and a lot of people, and I was born in 1957, so the people who are, quote, my grown-ups, who are people of that age, I've watched those people change because the social change starts with, you know, legislation, really. And now they are adjusting to it. And a lot of those folks really are making the best change that they can. So I talk about that, and it's a bit provocative for some folks. But Social change is a big, wide, huge subject that I like to address with a lightness. I don't ever want to hammer things into people because it doesn't work. Marguerite's a recovering racist.
and humor, for many of us, makes even very heavy topics more palatable.
Indeed.
Yeah.
That spoonful of sugar, as it were.
Well, in addition to those talents, you're a playwright, a produced playwright as well. You wrote a play, Through the Needle's Eye?
Yes, I did. Where'd you dig that one up?
Oh, I found it.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and this was produced, I believe, at Duke University?
Well, it was done at Georgia College in Milledgeville, and then it was at Duke University. The Divinity School performed it. Mm-hmm. A long time ago, and it's funny because I just played at Duke last week in the Duke Gardens concert series. So it was nice to go back there. I hadn't been back on the campus at Duke in a long, long time. But yeah, the Divinity School did it, and they did a pretty nice job. So it was a musical comedy about St. Francis.
A comedy?
Yeah.
And a musical?
Yeah. Oh, St. Francis, very funny fellow.
Were any animals in the production?
Well, I'll see. There was a donkey and a camel, but they were played by people.
Ah, okay.
And the song that comes out of that that I still perform occasionally is called Shove That Camel.
Andy, there is a quote attributed to you that I have seen around the country. It's always attributed to you. Many people have it on their websites now. I've heard it come up in conversation. It is, don't be afraid to be amazing. And this is something you said at some point, I believe, in a late-night conversation with a friend?
It was with Cindy Craven. And Cindy, we were just talking, and I was talking about actually what I have to tell myself all the time. When I'm afraid about doing something that hasn't been done before, because it really is frightening to step out and do something different. So I will tell myself, don't be afraid to be amazing. And Cindy said, where'd you get that? I said, I don't know. I made it up. And she put it on a quote website. I think it was Think Exist Quotes.
Oh, yes.
And it went crazy. It got picked up by, among other folks, the folks who painted the murals on the New Orleans Children's Library. So it's there. And so it has gotten around, and every once in a while, about twice a month, I get an email, may we borrow this quote? And, of course, I always say, sure, have fun. But it's something I believe. My favorite quote of Charles Schulz is when he said to himself, I said to myself, make Snoopy stand up, which changed his whole force of Peanuts, his comic strip. I sort of look back at that as well. I think when artists choose to do these new, exciting, crazy, scary things, that's when the good stuff happens.
Well, Andy Offutt-Irwin, the good stuff is definitely happening with you. You are new and exciting always.
Oh, thank you so much.
Absolutely amazing. Thank you for talking with us today.
I'm so excited and honored to be part of this. Thank you so much.
The Tonic theme was written and performed by Melanie Johnson.